In this wonderful book, For the Joy Set Before Us. We read that book in the Theology and Power work group that ran from 2000 to 2003, Augustine and Self-Denying Love. Recently, together with Duane Friesen, he co-edited At Peace and Unafraid, Public Order, Security, and the Wisdom of the Cross. Gerald is the lead author and editor of Just Policing. His new book, which he's speaking from today, Just Policing, Not War, An Alternative Response to World Violence. Did Jim Wallace write the foreword to that book? Is that sold a few copies for you?
They haven't been feeding me the numbers. I don't know how it's selling.
Well, after today, you'll see the Amazon ratings going down, or going up, I should say. Maybe going down. That wouldn't be good. Gerald is co-founder of Bridge Folk, a movement for grassroots dialogue and unity between Mennonites and Roman Catholics. He has also moderated the Mennonite Catholic Theological Colloquium and is a member at large on the Peace Committee of Mennonite Central Committee. It's wonderful having you back on this lovely spring evening now. It's become, Gerald, thanks for being here.
Well, I want to thank all of you for coming back into the room, most of you, and to everybody for not yet collapsing. It's kind of brutal to go last in a day that has been rich in really good papers and discussion. I am going to try to do things a little differently. I'm not working from a prepared text, not that the prepared texts haven't been good. Want to kind of walk you through the guide that we have available. First, a few preliminaries. If I had thought in time to retitle the presentation here, this would be the title: Just Policing, an Ecumenical Dialogue, A Case Study in Multilingual Peacemaking. Just Policing, an Ecumenical Dialogue, A Case Study in Multilingual Peacemaking. Because I want to work at a couple levels here. Obviously, I want to give a kind of a summary of what's going on with this Just Policing proposal, in what sense it is a proposal, et cetera, et cetera. But I did have a few misgivings about the phrase learning a language of peace. When I heard that came from Victoria Gray Adams, I was a little worried, but thank you to Johnny for letting us, maybe he's not here, oh, there he is, for giving us permission to interrogate a little bit language or languages of what's going on. If I have a little time at the end, I want to refer to the thicker little handout. We're going to walk through that, because what I really think, and this is actually indebted to John Howard Yoder, one of my professors and mentors, even though in some ways I maybe argue with him, but what I really think is that we need to learn multilingual skills. We need to learn to translate. We need peaceable skills of translation to work across worldviews, religious worldviews, and so on. Maybe this would also be akin to what Manuel talks about as bifocality. In any case, so that's the notice. At least pay attention to ways in which we're working at a couple different levels. Let's see, other preliminaries. So you should have this sort of chart. It works in two columns here, and kind of need a guide, Because what I'm doing, and part of what Just Policing proposal is about, it really is sort of two simultaneous conversations. And I want to take and I keep having to take pains not to collapse them into one conversation exactly. I'll say a little bit more about that. So I need to kind of give you a guide to follow the action as we go. Last little preliminary. The two columns, of course, Mennonites plus or et al. Or others, Catholics and all. I've, of course, been, as someone formed in the Mennonite tradition who's become Catholic, but without burning my bridges with the Mennonite community, I've been deeply involved in one particular set of conversations between Mennonites and Catholics, and so that's what those are the traditions I know best. But you can expand it if you want to talk about historic. The plus can be historic peace churches on the other side, other historic peace churches. You know, even maybe Catholic pacifists would really be more on that side in some of their views. Catholics, of course, are not the only ones to hold the just war theory, but the Catholic Church was for centuries sort of the custodian of it, and so on. So that's kind of the. And those two churches then become sort of archetypes for a conversation that across history that other people have been involved in. Okay, end of preliminaries. I'm not one who believes that 9/11 changed everything. As Stanley Hauer was rightly said, within days of 9/11, for Christians, it's the cross that changed everything. That's the center of history and so on. But obviously 9/11 did bring many issues to the fore, cast us suddenly, precipitously into many conversations and discussions that we probably wouldn't have had otherwise. So the first little row of issues that I want to point out here is how the Just War, Just Policing proposal grew out of the weeks and months following 9/11. Where on one hand, people in historic peace churches, Mennonites in particular, pressed like everyone else to say something about how else to respond besides a war on terrorism or a retaliatory, vengeful set of actions, many people said, don't treat it as a war, treat it as a crime. John Paul Lederach, leading peace practitioner, theorist, Jim Wallace, not Mennonite, but kind of a fellow traveler, and even the Executive Committee of Mennonite Central Committee all said things like that. Treat it as a crime. Run it through international courts. Of course, we need to strengthen international law, and it would have helped if the U.S. had been more supportive of international tribunals and so on. But that really would be the way to handle this. But, of course, that raised the question, if it's a crime, don't you need to apprehend the criminals? So are Mennonites and others implicitly supporting a kind of policing model? It at least indicates some unfinished business there. On the Catholic side, 9/11 helped to confirm the limits of the just war theory. On the right flank, the question of, well, does the just war theory really anticipate how you deal with non-state actors? It's been, formed in the context of governments, nation states, and so on. What about terrorist non-state actors? How do you deal with that? On the left, that in turn was part of an ongoing earlier debate. Should the just war tradition be understood very stringently as a very tight set of criteria, or permissively as opening up, giving a sort of general permission to statesmen, statescraft, practitioners of statescraft, who decides those kind of questions. The threat of terrorism from non-state actors seemed to warrant, from the right flank, throwing off the consensus that the just war tradition, above all, should constrict and discipline the waging of war. It seemed to give warrant for a broader, more totalizing war on terror. And then, once we got to Iraq, the doctrine of preemptive war. From the left flank, the worries about the just war theory would go something like this, that the non-traditional nature of war, as was being proposed, or was being practiced by non-state actors, or what the Pentagon now calls asymmetrical warfare, is only the latest in decades-long tendency of war to draw in civilians, to bring more and more so-called collateral damage, exploding a wider crater, so to speak, so that even if you target carefully, you're still drawing in more people, more civilians. The problem of when, in fact, as Paul Ramsey argued, non-combatant immunity ought to be the very linchpin of the just war tradition, which keeps it from sliding into a very undisciplined kind of mode. So those are some of the issues opened up there by 9-1-1. Of course, as I've already said, this is behind some things I've mentioned, are some prior problematics that people have been dealing with. Again, on the back to the Mennonite Historic Peace Church side, over the last few decades, there has been a growing movement from emphasizing non-resistance to nonviolence, coming to peace with kind of Gandhian active nonviolence, moving into justice advocacy, and so on. The question that at least I suggest has gone unanswered in that is, what happens if in your justice advocacy or your nonviolent campaign you actually win once in a while? I've articulated this already in this meeting. What if I put they in quotes because there is a kind of an us-them mentality of, you know, those military people, those government, but what if they actually pay attention and ask you to help? Do you get now involved? I mean, doesn't the logic of moving to justice advocacy require you to get more involved in government? An unfinished agenda there on that side. On the Catholic side, Vatican II had made an almost unprecedented kind of move when in Gaudium et Spes, sections 80 plus, it called for a complete reappraisal of war in the modern era. Now, the significance of that may not be obvious in this room of mostly Protestants, I think. But in fact, the Catholic Magisterium rarely makes official pronouncements until there's been a long debate that has, they at least see it as having sort of settled the issue. What the bishops at Vatican II did is open up a debate. They laid out, here's the problems with modern warfare, all of these things prompt us to call for a reappraisal of war in the modern era. Quite unprecedented. Be a number of things to say about, you know, what's been happening since. What I'm signaling here on my chart is whether pacifism and, or at least active nonviolence and just war are two traditions that work in parallel or work in sequence. Vatican II, the other thing at Vatican II was finally the church recognized that it's legitimate for a Catholic to renounce self-defense in favor of an ethic of nonviolence. Initially, that's limited to a very sort of personal choice. It's not a public position. That comes later in the the papacy of John Paul II. As my friend Drew Christensen has pointed out, there's kind of development in which nonviolence is applied more and more publicly. But how do then the two traditions work together? Just war and nonviolence, twin, equally valid Christian traditions. The parallel says, well, they both kind of just stand there together as twins. But that isn't entirely satisfying, and so you want to explain how do they work together. Well, maybe you try nonviolence first, and then just war as last resort again, as it was supposed to be all along. The pastoral letter of bishops in 92 or so, Harvest of Justice is Sown in Peace, has that kind of a sequential approach. But it's not really clear if this works. The twin approach doesn't say really what the relationship is, so you end up with, well, I won't go with that into that. The sequential approach, well, imagine that your neighbor has borrowed your tools and kept them for months and then a year, and you kind of finally get fed up and you go to talk to your neighbor, and you've even learned good conflict transformation skills. You're going to work with your neighbor with getting your tools back. But if you show up with a sidearm, the dynamics of the conversation changes. In other words, so if you're holding in reserve the clearly holding in reserve the possibility that, well, if all else fails, I might really use violence, then you actually become less likely to draw on your imagination to find nonviolent solutions, and at the same time, you're probably inciting the imagination of your neighbor. So again, prior problematics unresolved. And then if you notice on the chart, then I go to some things that are kind of cut across both traditions, because in fact, I'm referring to decades in which people are starting to discover growing convergence between at least people who apply the just war tradition stringently and pacifists who are at least willing to get involved in some kind of public issues. There's commonality, but also shared problems. The concept of nuclear pacifism or modern war pacifism refers to people on the just war side who say, yeah, in theory there could be just wars, but in the modern world I just don't see how the criteria could even be met, ever be met. The commonality, though, includes some common problems, and so that's the next bullet point. The problem of failed states, of genocide, the new responsibility to protect, I've got the abbreviation there, R2P, doctrine. On the Catholic side, these are some of the most poignant reasons why the Vatican holds out for the just war tradition, even though none less than Ratzinger, now Benedict XVI, has signaled that the just war tradition may be inadequate for the modern world. On the historic peace church side, I know from my participation in Mennonite Central Committee, Peace Committee, that already before 9/11, there was some pretty hard work trying to figure out how do we respond to a Rwanda as pacifists, to failed states, and a honest kind of humble admission that in places where when NATO went into Kosovo, it did get easier for the MCC's people on the ground to do their work. Stability helped. And then there are places like Congo, been mentioned, where there's a local Mennonite communities, and because they, on one hand, because they've stayed out of politics, they have a reputation for not being so corrupt. At a certain point in the failed state, people are saying, can't you help us? And do they have a theology for that? Colombia, there in one meeting of MCC Peace Committee, Ricardo Esquivia spoke to us and said, what we need in Colombia is not less law and order, but more law and order, but real order based on the strength of civil society, what he called institucionalidad, strong kind of mid-level institutions. So, and that's all of this, for all of these reasons, 9-1-1 was only kind of a presenting issue in both traditions. Okay, next block here. Then what was the proposal? Which I won't go into the story, but kind of came to me in a rush about November of 2001. While I was at Mass and should have been paying attention, but maybe that was the presence of the Holy Spirit. I don't know. And so I rushed off to kind of at least sketch out the arguments here. Well, first of all, and I found over the years, I have to just keep saying this again and again. What I'm proposing here is an agenda for ethical discernment, above all, in each tradition. In each respective tradition, calling both traditions and, of course, working most closely with Mennonites and Catholics to be more coherent about what they really think of the ethics of policing, which strikingly has often been lost in all of the attention to issues of violence in warfare, militarism, and so on. It may be helpful, it is helpful to have these twin conversations in each other's hearing, because we learn from each other, we kind of goad each other to what it really takes to have coherent answers. But I'm not proposing a grand compromise right now, if ever. I'm saying there's been a certain amount of convergence between the two traditions. Whether there can be more and more convergence to the point of actually meeting on a shared ethic around just policing, I'm agnostic. But if we work on these things respectively and find we're somewhat closer, then we'll be in a position to decide whether further convergence is possible. Now, talk about community policing in the domestic sense as a fruitful possible meeting ground. Because after all, people in both traditions, when they emphasize all the kind of conditions that make for peaceful communities, that allow the police to function without ever having to draw arms, you know, that's work that people on both sides can agree on is important. Well, the proposal on the pacifist Mennonite side is, above all, come clean on the ethics of policing. Now, I've sometimes goaded Mennonites and maybe gotten myself in trouble for, you know, pressing this issue by saying, but, you know, Mennonites call the police just about as much as anybody. Is that consistent with a pacifist ethic or not? We've got Mennonites now who are lawyers, they're involved in the system and so on. I've said that to make the point that this is an unfinished area for discernment. It's sometimes unfortunately come across as though I'm really playing gotcha with Mennonites. Well, you're inconsistent, you might as well just join the police like everybody else does and so on. That's really not finally my message. Instead, I would call Mennonites, historic peace churches, to recognize that the police function is operative in all communities. Now, if you're reacting to all of this agenda because of memories of accounts of police brutality as though that's all that policing can ever be, let me give a quick thought experiment. Imagine that Adam and Eve took an extra couple decades to sin. So they had a little longer in the Garden of Eden, and little Cain and Abel are already born, and they're out playing. You can imagine they're playing with the lion and lamb, of course, their favorite pets. But they're late for supper. They're having so much fun with their favorite pets. So Adam, with no vicious words, certainly no violence, calls them to supper. Isn't he policing their little community in a sense? So and then there would be stories in Mennonite communities, colonies in Paraguay, where they had a kind of function. People who are sort of like police officers, but what they did was engage in conflict mediation when there's people, unarmed, until recently and until the Paraguayan nation state kind of moved in and so on. So there are those kind of stories. I've been debating with a kind of a Christian anarchist who's really worried about where some of this would go, who's discovered Mennonites and become a Mennonite and so on. And so when he gives account, he wants to draw on kind of pre-modern towns, villages, guilds in Europe that had a kind of a watch system to for a kind of policing. And I'm trying to tell him, look, that's policing too. And if it's unarmed, then okay. Next point, retrieve some of those stories. I mean, I read Josh's paper with a lot of interest because he's, in fact, doing some of what I'm calling on the Historic Peace Church side to do. Give us some models of nonviolent policing, the rule of Christ, and so on. Finally, on this side, there are, in fact, of course, now Mennonites in positions of power. And, it might be not just in government. I say it that way because John Yoder used to say it that way. Positions of power and professions and so on, where, in fact, they're involved in governing large institutions. And as you'll find, some of you have found in the reading from the biblical mandate, Yoder actually points to ways in which congregations ought to provide vocational testing for people in positions of power. Okay, so if there are any legitimate exceptions in which, pacifists get involved in government, maybe even in policing, they're going to policing has now constituted, hopefully, community policing kind of models. It's going to take careful vocational discernment and accountability. So I call on Mennonites and Historic Peace Churches to really pick up on some of those suggestions by Yoder and others about how to work with, when pacifists do get involved in government, in positions of power, how to make sure that their moral framework continues to be the Christian faith, the gospel, as accountable to local congregations. On the Catholic side, then, I call on just war people to come clean on ways that warfare and policing are different. I don't know, in the interest of time, whether to go. I guess I won't go into a lot of these, but basically, I put them under kind of two groups: psychosocial differences, in which sort of the intensity of warfare releases certain kind of passions, and the reason we have words like berserk in our language is that goes back to medieval people noticing what we see now in accounts of warfare on the ground, in which the adrenaline is so flowing that any kind of moral consideration gets lost. Whereas policing is structured, and here it's thanks to being more embedded. Here's where I use the word embeddedness: more embedded in the local community. There are ways in which it, at least there's an attempt to be much more accountable to the rule of law and so on. So this doesn't necessarily mean abandoning, and this is why I can't just call for a quick and easy convergence of the two traditions here. On the just war side, I'm not saying just, throw the whole thing out, but recognize that what you've been talking about for centuries as just war really only works if it's just policing. And there I have, you know, it's intended as a pun, just policing, as well as just policing. And again, I won't go into the details, but in the book I have a whole list of suggestions about some of what it would take for the Catholic Church to have institutions that really match the principle that war ought to be, that there ought to be a strong presumption against violence. If that's the principle, what kind of vocational testing do you need in congregations or in parishes? What should justice and peace studies programs at universities be up to? What should ROTC programs on Catholic universities be up to? They ought to be think tanks in moving towards what some people call transarmament, using Gandhian kinds of social principles to defend vulnerable populations in less and less violent ways, and so on. So all of this require, and then one more thing, of course, would require on the Catholic side a fairly serious cultural change in which, without necessarily renouncing just war tradition in the process of turning it into a just policing tradition, if you're going to really make war last resort, you've got to do an awful lot more to train people in active nonviolence. If they don't have tools for a first and second and third and maybe tenth resort, short of last resort, then, you know, soldiers have a serious penitential problem of, you know, not really fulfilling what the church calls for. So peacemaking has to be, in a phrase that I've been grateful to find, spreading church-wide and parish-deep on the Catholic side. Insofar as some of this does represent at least partial convergence, I would simply point to some precedents that already exist. Won't take a lot of time on this last section. There has, of course, been decades of grassroots and sort of mid-level collaboration around specific issues in peace groups, solidarity groups, Mennonites, Catholics, Quakers, Lutherans, whatever, coming together and working together. So, of course, none of this is entirely new. These precedents have made this moment, this kind of proposal possible. And secondly, as John Yoder used to point out, pacifism and stringent just war thinking have always been much closer to each other than what is in fact the operative ethic in most of our churches. A kind of crusading, whether the word is used or not. Total war. Yoder used to talk about Ramboism. George Lopez had a nice article in America a year or two ago about the sort of Dirty Harry ethic, or more recently the Jack Bauer ethic. One of the guilty pleasures in my family has been 24. But in which, you know, you do what you got to do. And, of course, you know, you've only got minutes to do it, so you don't have time to ask questions. So that's what I'm referring to there. The most important, at least in the circles I move, sort of precedent for this has been the Just Peacemaking project and then book edited by Glenn Stassen, in which Christian ethicists from both pacifist and just war traditions came together in the early 90s, try to learn from, you know, how a measure of peace had come with the end of the Soviet Union, the end of the Cold War, and so on. How had we gotten there? What could we learn from? And they identified 10 practices which they said are realistic, proven practices that both traditions can agree on. maybe for disparate, different reasons. Maybe on the just war side, it's if we're really going to meet the criterion of last resort, you got to do a bunch of these things first. On the pacifist side, if pacifism is going to be more than passivism, if nonviolence is going to be more than non-something, here's what you have to do. So maybe you have different reasons from the different traditions, but you can agree, and they in fact had found themselves getting tangled up in arguments over principles until they said, let's talk about practices instead. We may have different principles for the same practices. Even then, as I point out in the book, the weakest consensus came in their section where they talked about the role of the UN, nonviolent military intervention, again indicating a unfinished agenda. There are, after all, persistent questions. Roy was just talking to me a little bit about this before we started. On the pacifist side, you know, pacifism really is, for most pacifists, an absolute ethic. You know, if you're making exceptions, you're not a pacifist. So, wouldn't accepting just policing really equal accepting a better, more disciplined, more stringent version of just war, but still a version of just war? Maybe what just war was supposed to be about all along, but still the just war tradition. There's good reasons for pacifists to hesitate. And then the other persistent issue that I've already alluded to, okay, we can collaborate together in anti-war movements, but what about then alternative forms of government? Governance, can we collaborate there? On the Catholic side, I would suggest the persistent question, maybe less obvious, but what I think ought to be the question, is what is the place of exceptions? Catholic moral theology, despite maybe the reputation for being a harsh set of rules and so on, is, at least in the theoretical side, fairly clear that, you know, no set of rules can anticipate every possible circumstance, and so you build into the system a recognition that there have to be exceptions, whether it's a system of moral thought or legal system or whatever. So, you know, despite inside jokes about Catholic guilt, and maybe an outsider's view of Catholicism as replete with harsh rules, Catholics are, if anything, all too good at making exceptions. Part of the Mediterranean culture that hosts the global Catholic Church in Italy, after all, is, well, you got your rules, but we all know that, et cetera, et cetera. A friend of mine says that the greatest divide in Christianity is not between Catholicism and Protestantism, but between Northern European versions of Christianity. Manuel is laughing here, chuckling with me. But I won't go into the reasons that, in fact, it doesn't always work as well, even in theory, as that little account suggests. The more important issue is, in practice, what keeps, if there are legitimate exceptions, you know, if you've got a strong presumption against violence, but you say, but of course in some circumstances you might allow for at least, maybe SWAT team apprehensions of a psychopath or something like that, or, you know, legitimate cases where war is justifiable, what finally keeps the exceptions exceptional? Think about the average parishioner, my average student in my classes on this stuff. Just war, generally, as far as it goes, is this. I know there's a just war tradition, therefore, war must be okay, therefore, I'm not going to ask questions if the state asks me to you know, go and kill. And that's about as much as most parishioners, our students, know. So just war, which ought to discipline war, translates into war is justified, full stop. Even if you say, okay, sometimes justified, there's still often little attention to the sometimes. And then we're back to, then I would mention once again, the problem of putting these things sequentially. Even if I say war is a last resort, how do I close down my imagination if I go to my neighbor with a side, bearing a sidearm? So that I open up the possibility that, well, maybe in last resort I would use violence, but then knowing I've got that recourse, I don't think about the other options. So a number of ways in which, down through history, what's supposed to be exceptional becomes unexceptional. So, final little section. Enough already. By which I mean, just war pacifist debates have been at an impasse, going around in circles, tired for many decades, if not centuries. It's fine to keep arguing these issues, but only if we argue with our lives. Only if we argue through more coherent practices. So remember, what I'm suggesting is the just policing proposal is not a proposal for convergence now. It's two simultaneous conversations in which I've been saying to my pacifist friends, okay, here are the things you need to do to convince the other side. If war is wrong, what is right? It's fine to be anti-war, it's fine to be prophetic, but you've got to eventually move beyond simply the prophetic mode. Again, this is what I found very intriguing about Josh's paper, an example of trying to do that. And then a little bit of a technical point here. Demonstrate the validity of the Jeremianic model. I say that because John Yoder used to talk about the Jeremianic mode of, like the exiles in Babylon, Christians live in diaspora and in many nations ought to seek the peace of the nation without confusing their loyalties. So, okay, show how you can participate in governance by having some people, maybe exceptionally, even in government, like the, you know, Daniel and the Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego guys and so on in Babylon, while keeping their moral bearings. Show that that can help and it can really be viable as a way of truly Christian, careful participation in governance. On the other side, you know, the just war tradition is not going to be, simply not going to be convincing to pacifists, and that's important for those of us that are concerned about ecumenical dialogue and church unity, unless the exceptions can be shown to be exceptional. Final point, you know, is the just war tradition itself is countercultural. It will take a certain kind of cultural transformation in the Catholic world to recognize that. But finally, the point is not to be either countercultural or pro-cultural, but to be, to ask what does it take to build a humane culture. Sometimes you have to be in opposition, sometimes you're affirming. I would argue that the way that framed is often the wrong question. Okay, closing remarks. I probably went longer than I hoped again, like everybody else, but anyway. Again, one more time, because I've got to say it so often. Just war policing is not a proposal for a grand compromise. I don't know whether complete convergence is possible. What I am doing is urging both sides toward greater coherence within their own framework. And then we can see what else might be possible. When we get to the horizon, we can then get a next view of another horizon. But in the context of this conference, there's one more point about the language of peace. another kind of meta point or methodological point. I'm not convinced that we need a language of peace per se. Again, what I think we need are skills of translation, multilinguality, maybe it would be the word, but often bilingual, one conversation at a time. And so I present this to you as a kind of case study in how at least I've been trying to do that. It's complicated, and I know it's complicated by the fact I'm a Mennonite that's become Catholic, and people worry, okay, see, there's a slippery slope here. But I really see myself as trying to play the role of a translator across these traditions. Languages do converge over time. English is the result of the convergence of Germanic and Romance families of languages. But Esperanto has been a failure. So think of just policing this project as a case study in multilingual ethical discernment on the way to peace. And then if you want more, that's why I've given this additional handout. It's the closing section from another project I've been involved in Muslim-Christian dialogue, where I reflect a little bit on how this is possible.